Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Hey, it's Adam Carolla. You may know him from putting his body on the line in Jackass, but now Johnny Knoxville is bringing you the wildest stories from the bravest folks he knows on his newest podcast, Pretty Sure I Can Fly. With his co-host, Elna Baker, they have incredible firsthand accounts from folks who surfed 100-foot waves, ride 600 miles per hour in a rocket sled, and wrestle crocodiles just for fun. They've been talking with brave souls who throw caution to the wind and push the boundaries of what humans are capable of. Or, as Johnny would say, they're talking to people who have more balls than a bowling alley. I'm Pretty Sure I Can Fly. Johnny and Elna bring you personal stories from unsung heroes that are part comedy, part adrenaline, and all heart. These are the inspirational, hold my beer stories that will make you want to grab the bull by the horns, literally and figuratively. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcast. You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly right now, early and free, right now on Wondery Plus. One part extended interview today with Gabriel Iglesias, Fluffy, who's taken over the world, selling out shows at Dodger Stadium, everybody. So we'll talk to him. First, there's Geico. Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal? When it comes to great rates on insurance for everything, Geico can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance, they are all covered with Geico. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use Geico mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to Geico. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
Hey guys, Michael Malice here. Be sure to check out my weekly podcast, You're Welcome with Michael Malice, now on Podcast One. You might know me from my terrible Twitter, my horrible books, or the nonsense I spout on podcasts like Rogan and Glenn Beck. It's all there. Are you black-pilled or white-pilled for the future of the UK? What is a man?
What is a man?
What is a no? What is it? Are you white pilled or black pilled? No, seriousness, girl.
No. I love the Jesse Lee piece of question.
The fact that you discovered that gives me hope for some of the things that I've still got that are missing.
Well, if you need James G. Blaine's autograph, you are welcome to it. Of course, being the co-author of How to Have Impossible Conversations makes you the perfect guest for this train wreck of a show. New episodes are available every Thursday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and wherever you get your podcasts. You are welcome.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Today, Adam sits down one-on-one with Gabriel Iglesias. And now, wondering if people who make candles are in the beeswax. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on the church making a mandate. Get it on and welcome Gabriel Iglesias. We love to speak to Gabriel. Always puts a smile on my face. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. 2014, huh?
Yeah, it's been too been long. I was watching, I don't know if it's your last stand-up special, but one of your stand-up specials just a couple of days ago. Not really in preparation for this, just started watching it.
Thank you.
And I thought it was really, that means a lot. Funny.
Usually with comics watching other comic specials, that's, you know, it's rare.
No, and I was really impressed that the skill you had, but I'm also kind of thinking like you're a storyteller with lots of jokes peppered in. I guess that would be the style.
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And we'll talk about cars and VW buses and all the stuff you love, because I love all that shit too. First, I should say, Dodger Stadium, May 7th, coming up, that is sold out. Sold out at Dodger Stadium. That is a stadium where the Dodgers play that is sold out, and a new show, his second show, has been added the day before on May 6th. There's Fluffy in the field. We're putting people out in the field, and when that fills up, we'll get them back out into the bleachers.
Maybe. Well, here's the thing is that, you know, we're doing a taping for Netflix. So you always want to have a backup just in case. So that's why anytime I tape a special, I tape two shows just in case something happens. And something always does happen, whether it's a technical or somebody being ghetto in the crowd or, you know, you never know. I've had Amber Alerts go off during my show. So right. That's, you know.
But mostly people do that in a club or maybe a mid-sized theater. They don't add a second show to a stadium, which is crazy.
It sounds surreal.
It's real. Well, you and I both opened for Joe Coy at the Forum a couple of years back, and that was big enough. I was like, God damn, he sold out the Forum. This is crazy. But Dodger Stadium is 45,000 people?
That's exactly what it was.
Jesus, you know, H. Christ. Mm-hmm. What size venues do you play around the country?
Usually, places where they do basketball games. So mm-hmm. Just basketball arenas.
Is L.A. really your home crowd?
Yes, absolutely.
You're from here. I'm from here. Mm-hmm. You're, Long Beach?
Yeah.
Where'd you grow up?
Long Beach.
Long Beach. And tell us about growing up. I'm curious about that life.
Well, which part? Single parent, the last of six kids, born in San Diego, but grew up in Long Beach. So from second grade until I graduated from high school, it was Long Beach, and I still live there.
Was comedy always the plan?
It was the dream. I don't know that it was the plan. You know, usually the plan involves a lot more safety, a lot more security. You know, you want to make sure you have benefits. You have certain things that, you know, your parents will tell you certain things. You want to make sure you have a good, you know, insurance. And when you're a kid, you don't care about insurance. That's not your priority. You dream. I wanted to either be a comic or a transformer. So one of the two was going to happen. I was 10 years old. I did a school talent show, and I fell in love with it.
You did stand up at age 10.
Yes.
In front of the whole school?
In front of a full auditorium of kids.
Whoever made it.
Whoever was there.
How'd it go?
It went very well.
Do you remember any of the jokes? Or do you remember any of the process?
I remember how scared I was. I remember how scared and excited I was. Basically, what I did was I went out on stage. I didn't really consider it comedy. I considered it more like I was doing impressions and characters, and I wasn't sure what the reaction was supposed to be. And then someone told me, well, you should break the ice with the crowd by telling a joke. I'm like, I don't know any jokes. And then they said, well, here's a joke for you. And 10-year-old me goes on stage and says, why'd the chicken cross the road? And I said, to check out the chicks. And people started laughing. I'm like, is that supposed to happen?
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that that was the reaction. And then I started doing impressions. So a little kid, you know, doing impressions of Pee Wee Herman, Yogi Bear, Ronald Reagan. Keep in mind, this is 1987.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I would do them, they'd laugh and clap. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's what's supposed to happen. And at the very end, I was just so scared and so relieved that I was off stage. And then people started coming up and go, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And I'm like, I did not know how to take it. I just knew that I did something that was cool.
And was it that from that point on? Like,
oh, that was it. I was hooked.
Bit
was
by hooked. The bug?
Yes.
But at age 10, you know, you hear these stories of comedians, Chris Rock, whoever, they're young, their mom drives them to the club and stuff like that, but not a 10 or 11-year-old version of that story.
The 10-year-old version of me was basically, that was what inspired me. It's not like I started doing stand-up right after that. It was another 10 years before I actually got up on stage and called myself a comic and tried to do it for real.
Where was that?
Long Beach.
And so why? I mean, I know you had to take 10 to 16, 17 off, but you made it a full decade. Like, what were you doing at 18?
Well, you know, it was one of those things where I was in school and I didn't really have a way to, you know, my mom wasn't about to take me to a club. And then I tried going to a comedy club in Long Beach. There used to be a comedy club in Long Beach right there on Pine. And my brother actually took me there one night, and we tried to go in, and they're like, nope, he's a kid, he can't come in. He goes, well, he just wants to watch. Mm-hmm. Like, nope, can he stand at the door and watch? They're like, nope, you need to get up, you need to back up. You got to be 21 and over to enter and even be there. So they kicked us out. So the only way that I got access to comedy was, you know, watching HBO or, you know, Def Jam. That was the thing to watch back then. I got into football. I got into just sports and all kinds of other things in high school, and then I got into speech. And debate. And I think that's what really sparked everything. Every day I was getting up in front of the class just to talk. I didn't have to be funny. All I had to do was talk and talk about my day. And the teacher was always inspiring us to get up in front of people and just tell us about your day. The whole idea is to get over your fear of public speaking. And just, you know, public speaking is something that people need. And if you're good at this, you'll always have something. And so every day I'd get up in front of the class and talk. And I hated turning in stuff in writing. So it was just me going up in front of the class. And I got an A for just going up in front of the class every day.
Where was your mom and your siblings with the comedy? Did they supportive? Did they think it was you were good, you had something, or were they trying to steer you in some other direction?
You know, in school, you could say whatever it is you want to do. And as long as it's something that makes you happy, then they're supportive. But it's not until you got to pay some bills and then they're like, hey, mm-hmm. you know, because I had a decent job. I used to work for a company called Robinson's May, which became which before was Robinson's. And then it was May Company. And then they merged, became Robinson's May. And now Macy's bought them out. So, you know, I used to do telemarketing and customer service.
And so you had a job. Was your dad around anywhere?
No, I've got a single parent. My mom did everything on her own. Dad was out of the picture when I was 4 years old, and he was an entertainer. He was a mariachi.
Oh,
he performed
really?
All over the place. And so, you know, 20 some odd years later, after being an entertainer, I have a whole different understanding of my father's position in life and realize, you know what, there's two sides to every story. So
did he circle back and try to reconnect with you?
He did about 15 years ago. And I wasn't ready. And and recently, probably this last in December, his birthday's ironically enough, December 25th. So it's like, sorry, I don't remember, Dad. It's you and Jesus. So my cousin reached out and she's like, hey, I'm here with your dad. I go, well, you tell him I said hello. Mm-hmm. And he was so excited that I said hello. And he sent me this long paragraph of like, you know, there's no way to change the past, but if there's an opportunity to hang out, I'd love it. And I'm like, you know, I might give that to him.
Well, it's funny. I was interviewing Gene Simmons from Kiss last week, sitting where you're sitting, and he never met his dad. And he grew up in Israel, or was born in Israel and then moved out here. Mm-hmm. And he said later on, he said, you know, when Kiss became the biggest band in the world, that he always would send money back and kind of support him and bought him a house and stuff like that. But he just didn't emotionally have the connection. And I think there's two different heads on that. One head is it's your blood. And then the other head is more of a Gene Simmons head on it, which is I didn't know the guy. Like, why do I need to start knowing him now? No. With an element of, hey, son of a bitch, shouldn't have left. You know, where are you like in that world?
I was in that for many, many years. And again, I think it just took me being an entertainer and living this lifestyle to where I had a different respect and understanding for his position back then. Because he's an entertainer. He's on the road every single week. My mom met him at a show. They got together. They, you know, they spent some time together. And my mom made it very clear that she loved him. She goes, no, I really loved him. And she's like, you know, you were made with love. And I'm like, well, apparently I was made with mariachi music too. But for me, for many years, I was just resentful of the fact that I didn't have a dad. And it was more so because people would ask me, where's your dad? And so that would always be like, well, it's just my mom. Well, what about your dad? Well, I don't have a dad. And then it was always those questions. And so that, I think, built up more angst than anything. It was like, oh, like, God, I hate this. But at this point, I think I'd want to just hang out with him to hear him talk about my mom. You know, my mom's gone. So I would love to hear his stories about getting to know my mom and what she was like, because she really spoke highly of him until she didn't.
Are you the only child from that?
Yes. So all my siblings are half, and they're much older. So there's like a 13, 14-year gap between my sister and myself. Mm-hmm. So it was like growing up an only child because there was nobody else in the picture.
And so do you think your dad circled back because he started to hear about you, or do you feel like he was just come to a place where he wanted to reconnect?
I think it's got to be a combination of the two, because I would do bits about him. Mm-hmm. And so he found out, because, you know, family here, family there. It's a big family. And, you know, regardless of whether it's him having regret or wanting to get to know me, or the whole comedy thing, is just, you know, I'm cool either way.
So you guys feel like you're going to reconnect at some point?
I think so. He's 80 years old now, and at this point, you know, come on, you know, he's already made his money. He's got his own house. He doesn't need anything from me other than just, hey, can we have a connection? So I think he knows that, and I'd be open to it.
So we'll jump back in time. So now you're 20. You got the job at Robinson's May. I remember the May Company out here. Mm-hmm. and Robinsons. What's Robinsons, right?
It was, what is it, J.W. Robinsons? It was, yeah. Like they used to have those fancy commercials with the guy with the accent.
So you're doing all right, but not, you know, you're not living the dream. And you always have comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were always a clown in high school, junior high, and all that. Were you a class clown?
No. And believe it or not, I was actually very serious. It wasn't until I got up in front of the class that, you know, when I had eyes on me, that's when I turned it on. That's when I'm like, all right, let's have fun. You know, but for the most part, though, if it's just me solo, I'm very, you know, I got one or two people around me. I usually listen. I'm really good at just listening, read the room, see what's going on. I've hung out with a lot, as I'm sure you have. Some guys just don't turn it off. And after a while, man, you're just like, dude, just come on. Can we hang out? Can we just have a drink? Is it cool?
Yeah, it's a little obnoxious. And it's kind of like, it'd be fun having sex with a porn star, but not every night. You know, it's like it's almost too much. You know, some guys who can't just shut it down, and maybe they can shut it down, but because they're in front of you, they're wanting to impress. Mm-hmm. You know, and so part of it is kind of a tip of the cap, you know, to you, because they're only doing it to try to get you to sort of appreciate like, hey. Them. Yeah, that guy, the guy sells out Dodger Stadium, thinks I'm funny.
Nice.
So,
but back in school though, it was just, you know, I wasn't trying to be, you know, over the top or attention. It was just, I enjoyed being up in front of people. For some reason, I felt like a certain level of respect that I didn't get in just regular everyday life. I was always a chubby kid. My teeth were messed up. I was not popular. I had pimples all over my face. And so it was just, you know, I was regular. I was just average or below average in the hallways. But when I got up in front of that class, I commanded a certain level of like, no, now you're going to listen. And people were like, oh, tell us more stories. And so they enjoyed that. They wanted to feel connected. They wanted to be close, and they would talk to me after differently. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is what really motivated me, because I'm like, when I'm up here, man, I matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I stand out.
So then we go to 20 and you're going out on stage. Now, have you been performing, or is this getting back to it at age 20 for the first time?
Getting back to it, but at the same time having a year's worth of being in the speech. Remember, I was able to get up in front of class every day. So I was very comfortable once I decided I wanted to try stand-up again, you know.
Yeah.
Getting up there, I wasn't afraid to be up there. I wasn't afraid to talk, and I wasn't afraid of silence. So I just had to work on, all right, let's try doing the whole character thing again. So I went up there, just started doing voices. And you know, little by little started building that setup.
Yeah, I taught comedy traffic school for like a year.
Mm.
And I didn't know what I was doing, but I was doing the same thing you were doing in speech class, which is, if I can stand in front of these people, in this case for like 7 hours, because the class was like 8 hours. I don't know, you got a half hour lunch and 10-minute breaks here and there. But it was probably shook out to be about 6.5-7 hours of standing there in front of this hostile crowd. Like, mm-hmm. They didn't want to be there. They mostly blamed me for some reason. I didn't get the fucking ticket.
Yeah.
I was just a teacher. But I thought, if I can stand and really do this in front of these people, then that'll translate into something. You know, then 15 minutes is not going to feel that long on a comedy stage.
Yeah, you've done hours.
I'm doing hours. So it's kind of interesting, because now when I think back on your stand-up, it's pretty conversational. It's storytelling. I can now see that base you built with the speech class.
Mm-hmm.
And it's jokes, but it's jokes woven in very, very skillfully, and not just a sort of set up punchline style.
Yeah, I've never been good at just regular setup punch. It's more so just let me go up and talk and be as fun and as just enjoy the story that I'm telling. And I think as long as I'm having fun with it, then they're like, okay. You know, it's whatever the mood is that you're trying to create in that, depending on what you're talking about. You know, there are certain times when I'll talk about stuff that gets deep, like my dad or the passing of my mom, or situations where you're just struggling with relationships, or, you know, mistakes that you've made. And you don't necessarily want to make it a hoo hoo ha ha moment. You need to make it a situation that people understand. Like, this was a rough patch. This was a rough moment. And so you gotta you know, apply that accordingly.
Well, one of the stories we're talking about, some weight loss stories in there. Always, I think you're at your
I go up and down.
Because 445 was your peak.
Peak, yeah.
Right.
And so right now I'm 100 pounds lighter than that.
How did you get down 100 pounds?
The first time I did yoga, and I stopped eating like an asshole. So, it was bad. I was just – every night it was Thanksgiving. People say, going on the road with Gabriel Iglesias could cure world hunger. Because every night we were just going for it. Every single – and then people, of course, I had the whole – the Gabriel Iglesias loves chocolate cake. So every night people would bring pastries and cakes and cookies, and it was just excess every single night. And so, you know, you're going for it and then you're passing out right after, and you're not doing much during the day except for heading to the next place to do the show. And so, yeah, I just put on all those pounds. And so eventually when we decided, okay, after visiting the doctor, and the doctor's like, dude, this – come on. You got to stop. You're young, so you can recover, but – you know, if you keep this up, it's going to catch up. And so I started doing yoga. I stopped eating everything. I stopped drinking for a while, and then the pounds came off.
Yeah, there's not, you know, it's nothing magic about it.
It's not rocket science.
It isn't. It's just kind of diet and exercise. And like I said, don't eat like an asshole. I know you worked during Mr. Iglesias with my partner, Kevin Hench.
Kevin!
And I love that guy. That guy's on keto. Pretty damn hard.
Kevin Hench, I'd always make fun of him. I go, hey, so how much salmon did you have today? Because the guy doesn't even try, and you can always see veins, and he's always ripped. And I'm like, dude.
Yeah. I know. It's so – I go out to dinner with him frequently, and it's like
– what bread?
Yeah, bread, nothing. You get nothing you want. Because what I've realized is – I was talking to Dr. Drew about this, but you can tell me. But I think this is a good way to go. I have friends I can go out to dinner with, and when the bread basket comes around, they go extra butter. And then there's Kevin Hench.
Yes.
And then there's Dr. Drew, and then there's a couple other people. And when I go out with them, I don't get the bread, and I don't get the potato because I feel ashamed. Like they're looking at me. They're going to watch me eat this bread basket, and it's more painful than whatever the pain is of denying myself the bread. And I started to kind of realize if you can get more of those people in your universe, it'll slow your roll a little bit.
I go to eat with my personal trainer. And in the beginning, it was uncomfortable because he's like, yeah, man, blah, blah, blah. And he starts telling you about the workout plan and then how you got to eat. But then we go eat, and he's like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, because, you know, in the gym, he's like, yeah. But then we go eat, and he's like, dude, man, you're going to order cookies? I'm like, this is crazy. I'm hanging out with my personal trainer eating, and he's like, go for it, dude. So there's no, you know, but I do have friends that I definitely do not enjoy being around when I'm eating, because they have a very different life.
It's, like I said, it can be. It's kind of interesting. Like I grew up with a lot of guys that didn't want to be around successful people because it was kind of shaming to them. They wanted to hang around. I had a friend. He'd meet these guys playing pickup basketball and hang out with them. And he was kind of the belle of the ball, even though he just lived in a shitty apartment in North Hollywood, but he had free cable or whatever. So he was like the big fish in the small pond. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking, I'd rather hang around with successful people and be the least successful person there, but try to up my game.
And learn from everybody.
And learn from them versus be the most successful loser in this pack of otherwise losers. And yeah, I don't know how you feel about that, because we both sort of come from the old neighborhood a little bit. You got to kind of deal with that. We grew up regular, high school, all that shit. Do you have a lot of your old friends? Do you have like the neighborhood guys? Are there the guys you tried to help, but they tell you, you're not the fucking boss of me just because you're big star, Fluffy?
It's funny you mentioned that. I had a conversation recently, and I come to find out apparently I was the most successful out of everyone, and that I needed to start having more. I needed to start hanging out with different people that were trying to be driven, people that, you know, had their own businesses, people that thought outside the box, that weren't just doing the same thing they were doing back in high school. Because haven't, you know, grown the circle much over the years. I mean, there's, of course, once you get into the business, there's the business side of it. But as far as just having regular relationships with just, can we be cool, you know, hang and stuff like that, it hasn't grown very much.
Yeah, I think people think there's a certain nobility in hanging around with the old guys from the neighborhood. And there kind of is, but some of those guys aren't fantastic. Some of those guys just want you to invest in their Froyo company that they got a plan. They want to open in Arizona, and they're always
putting that's funny. Frozen yogurt or frozen ice, either one. Yeah,
they're always hitting you up for some business idea. And sometimes it's nice to
hear me out. Hear me out.
You want to diversify a little bit and hang out with some other people that are doing other things.
Other things. Yeah. No, I recently started talking to other people that have enlightened me to certain things. I'm like, and my head hurts because I'm like, I don't want to hear about this NFT. I'm
right.
What do you mean crypto? Like the arena? No.
But you do. I've talked to some of those guys too. And then you do realize, oh, there's a whole world out there of people that are doing shit that when we grew up, you didn't have any idea that those people, I mean, you saw them on TV maybe, but you didn't know they were out in the wild, like with their hustle on, taking care of business, just living that life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, what'd your mom do for a living?
My mom did whatever she needed to do at the time. She did so many different things. But I remember one thing she told me was, you know, stop playing those video games because they amount to nothing. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. And like now I see people making money playing video games and it's just like, are you kidding me? You know, and then being able to create businesses inside of this metaverse and like it's this rabbit hole of like things that are possible and you don't even have to leave your house. And it's scary.
Yeah, it's scary. And it's also scary if you have kids because you can't really tell them, oh, you'll never amount to anything
you can't
doing
use those
X,
anymore.
Y, or Z.
Yeah.
You know, come from the dad who does a podcast. You know what I mean? Like a job that didn't exist 10 years ago. So.
And I start to feel like someone who doesn't want to grow because I'm like, I don't want to put on the virtual reality glasses. I'd rather just go outside. They're like, oh, there's this whole thing and you can learn and this. And I'm like,
Well, speaking of outside, I think I was watching a thing with you on Jay Leno's Garage, and you got one of your VW camper vans or something. I'm having a vague recollection of this. And
yes, we went to El Dorado Park and right there in Long Beach.
How many vans do you have now?
Oh, wow. Somewhere between 25 and 30. And the reason why I don't know the actual number is because some of them are being restored and some are just shells.
Yeah,
so, I mean, there's registrations, but a solid amount that I could just get into and drive right now is at least 22.
What's the jewel and the crown of Fluffy's collection? What is the best VW bus you have?
Ooh, I have three that I consider to be equal. They're all 23 window buses. They're lowered. I know. they're tricked. They're
you get to them, they'll be they're, lowered
they're,
anyway.
They're tricked. Ah!
You can have that one.
But there's three, and each one is probably valued around 200.
Yeah, people don't realize that VW buses weren't worth anything back in the day, and like old surfers would just buy them and mm-hmm. use them and shit like that, hippies. And then a few years ago, they started coming on.
Yeah.
And then at some point, it was like, $100,000 for a VW bus, and
once
like,
that happened at the Bear Jackson auctions on TV were the ones that started driving the price up because people started spending crazy money.
And there are really cool pieces, and I had a friend who had one growing up, pretty indestructible, and just worked. I mean, we would put seven or eight people in that thing and leave North Hollywood and go to Malibu, and the thing was gutless, but we all packed in and we all hauled ass and we drove that thing like a maniac. We'd go off-roading on that thing up on like dirt Mulholland. We went and drove around the school. I went to Walter Reed Junior High. We drove around the lawn and then jumped off the curb and everything. It's like you can't really break those things, and the Germans knew what they were doing, even though,
you know, it's like a van SUV type, you know.
Yeah.
it's high enough off the ground where you could drive off the sidewalk.
Do you have any other cool stuff in your collection?
Aside from the I made my little Volkswagen museum there, and aside from the buses, and it's mostly buses, I do have two Bugs.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not like, there's nothing crazy about them or nothing that really stands out. They're just regular Bugs. But I do have a muscle car alley, so I have a complete opposite direction. So the buses are slow and low, and then I got the muscle cars. So I got a big Dodge fan, Mopar. So I got a Challenger, Charger, Hellcat, 300, Trackhawk, Demon, and I have the Bandit, the 2015 Bandit from
Is that
Trans Am Depot?
Is that a Camaro?
It's a Camaro that was converted into a Trans Am from Trans Am Depot.
Smoking the Bandit. Yeah, I think I saw on another Leno's Garage episode or the same one. I think you were just getting a delivery of that car.
Yes, yes. So I got those crazy cars, and then I got the bugs. The buses.
So you were circling back now. You get up on stage at 20. You do the voices. I don't know if people know that you do all those voices, but they're woven in quite effectively in your stand-up act.
You know who I was a big fan of as a kid was an impressionist by the name of Rich Little.
Sure.
Rich Little, back in the day, he was the guy that you would see at all these roasts. So the Dean Martin roast, you know, all the Comedy Central stuff you see today was based on all those old school roasts from the, you know, late 70s, early 80s. And Rich Little was always one of those guys that would be on stage doing impressions of whoever was being roasted to the T. I mean, this guy was the greatest impressionist I've ever heard.
He's still around. I think he's in Vegas. I think I looked him up a few months ago.
I would pay to go see Rich Little.
I think, Chris, didn't we look up Rich Little and he was in Vegas recently, and he's performing somewhere? Yeah, that was him up there, big velvet tux, big bow tie, and just doing all that. I was the same way. I would watch that stuff and
just
go,
awesome. Oh. Best Carson, best everybody. I mean, you know, and I remember seeing what was the movie called where it was the Late Night Wars?
Oh yeah.
I remember
it was called Late Night.
The Late Shift, I think, or something like that. Yeah. And I remember he played Johnny Carson in the movie, and it was just like, wow.
So
you close your eyes and you could really see Johnny.
You could do the voices. You had the storytelling. You had the chops from doing the speech class. And now you get up and perform. Goes pretty good. You feel good. You have that same feeling again you had when you were 10.
Excited. Just getting off the stage and you can't wait to do it again. You're like, oh.
So when did things start to happen for you?
Well, because of the fact that I was 20 years old when I first started, I still couldn't go into a Laugh Factory or a Comedy Store. I couldn't go in. I wasn't old enough to be in the room. How Eddie Murphy or anybody else did it back in the day is beyond me. However they worked that out, but I could not just show up and walk in. They wouldn't let me do it.
When you were 20, you probably looked like you were 14.
I had a very baby face, and I didn't have no facial hair, and I just, you know, I looked like I needed to get carted in the parking lot, period. So so all of my stand-up happened at bars in the hood. I started in Montebello here in California, and it was one of these – it was like a Mexican restaurant during the day, and then it had its bar area, and then they would show Laker games, and then as soon as the game was over, they'd have comedy on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And so I show up there one night with a couple buddies of mine, and there was a comedy show happening. And I said, man, I'd love to get up there. And they're like, well, go talk to them. But I was already so conditioned to hear no from everybody that, you know, anytime I tried to get close. So my buddy goes, hey, I'll go talk to the guy and see if I can get you, you know, maybe 5 minutes. And I was like, oh, my God. So he goes back there and he goes, yeah, come on back. And just like that. And so I went up on stage and I had, you know, for the time, it was a really good set where they're like, hey, you want to come back? And so I came back, and then, hey, you want to come back? I'm like, yeah, I'll come back. And then, hey, and then they handed me a piece of paper, and they said, sign right there. I go, why? Well, they're going to give you $50. I'm like, oh, shoot. And a month in, a comedian named Joy Medina, who was booking rooms, he was booking spots in El Paso, Texas at a comedy club called Bart Reed's Comic Strip. He needed an MC. He goes, have you ever MC'd? And I didn't even know what MC'd meant. Mm-hmm. That's how new I was. I had no idea. I'm like, MC, like, you know, and I thought rapping. I'm like, MC, like, MC, you know, MC Breed, MC. Like, well, you know, I can get funky, but I don't know. He goes, well, I'll tell you what. He goes, I can get you $150 to go on the road, you know, El Paso, Texas. You'll work, you know, Wednesday through Sunday, and you just MC the show. And somebody told me, he goes, yeah, you just host. Oh, okay, host. Okay, I get it. And then he gave me another gig for $50 in Phoenix, Arizona the week before. And that was my first time going out. And that was 2 months from the time I started. So 2 months after I started, I was on the road.
And getting paid.
Well, wasn't a whole lot, but I still had my job. I had a really good job working for a company called LA Cellular, which eventually became AT&T Wireless. Mm-hmm. And I was killing it. I was bringing home $5,000 a month in commissions. Yes, I was doing really well selling cell phones. And this is back before iPhones, before Samsungs. This is when the popular phone at the time was a Motorola PC550 flip phone. They call it, like, it was a brick phone, and the battery would last a week. You'd put this thing in, it's like a nickel metal hydride battery, and you charge it one time and the battery would work for a whole week. And if you dropped it, you'd probably dent the floor. These things were indestructible, not like these things now. And I was doing very well for myself. And that's when my mom told me, what are you doing? You're making money. You have insurance. Your card says PPO. I go, what does that mean? She goes, it means that you're going to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. And so she was mad when I quit my job to do stand up on the road for $50 or $150 when I was making $5,000 a month.
Did were you really good at your jobs? You were talking to people, you're selling them stuff.
You didn't really have to sell it. I mean, I was set up in a kiosk inside of a Walmart, and the little booth had the cell phones laid out. And, you know, if you came by, you had to pass a credit check. You had to do the whole background, you phone call and a deposit. You know, it's either $200, $500, or $1,000, or they got to buy the phone outright.
Which Walmart was it?
I worked at a few different ones. I worked at the Walmart in Cerritos, the Walmart in Paramount, the Walmart in Anaheim, the Walmart in Irvine. Also a bunch of different Home Base. Remember Home Base? It was like Home Depot.
Yeah, yeah.
So a bunch of those as well. And Anaheim and all over the place. And I think those eventually became Lowe's, if I'm not mistaken. But I did that for a while. And then I was burning the candle at both ends, because once I started going out and doing shows, and by the way, all the shows were at bars. Mm-hmm. They were all at bars. I did not get into a comedy club until I went to El Paso, Texas.
Did you just get in a van and hit the road kind of thing? Or
when I went to El Paso, I took a bus. It was like a ghetto Greyhound, which can it get any more ghetto than Greyhound? It was a bus company called Turismo Rápido, which is means like rapid transit or tourism that's fast. And, you know, you paid your $75 and they take you from L.A. to El Paso, Texas. And man, it's rough, like the things you'd see on those buses. And so I did that for a while.
It couldn't have been anyone else on that bus who was going there to do comedy.
Probably not. And it was funny because once I got into El Paso, I called up the comedy club manager and he goes, yeah, I'll go pick you up. And I was waiting out in front of the place forever and I kept calling him and he goes, I went down there to pick you up. You weren't there. I go, I'm standing here. The sign says Turismo Rápido. He goes, I went to the Greyhound station. I go, I can't afford Greyhound. I'm at the place, you know, down the road.
Was it, did you drive all through the night? I mean, how long was
it? On the bus? Yeah, it was all night. Me driving, I'm good for 5 hours, and then that's it. So I never drove more than 5 hours anywhere.
But was the how long was the bus ride from L.A. God, to
about 15.
El Paso?
Because it had stops.
Uh-huh.
It had stops, so it was about 15 hours.
Wow. So you get there. Now you're at a comedy club.
Mm-hmm.
You're not at a bar anymore. You're still not 21 yet, but they don't care.
No. I started doing stand-up April 10th, 1997, I was 20 years old. And by the time I got to El Paso, so April, May, June, so 3 months in. It was 3 months in, not 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Because by the time I got to El Paso, I was 21.
Oh, okay. So now you're 21, you're in a proper comedy club,
mm-hmm.
and you're doing hosting, emceeing. And how's it going?
And what's funny is because I still have my day job, you know, I basically took the week off.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you got to figure, I was 20 years old. I was balling at 20 years old with, you know, making $5,000 a month. I had no expenses. My car, you know, I had just gotten a new car, so my payments were minimal. My rent was $350 a month. You know, I was always getting free food at Walmart. They were always hooking me up with free stuff. So I had all this disposable income. So we're at the comedy club or the comedy condo, and I'm there with two other comics, and I'm taking them out to dinner. And they're looking at each other like, you bully this kid? He wants to take us out to eat. I go, yeah, come on. They're like, what's the club paying you? I go, they're paying me shit. I go, but I got a real job.
Mm.
And so they thought that was the most, you know, interesting thing. I was working with a comic named Dan Bradley. I don't know if you remember that name.
Hmm. I don't think I know
Dan
that.
Bradley. He was an old school guy. He used to do A&E's Evening at the Improv. Just unfortunately, you know, he's one of those guys that he took his own life a few years back.
Wow.
But it was great working with him. You know, learned a lot from just being around these vets.
So you're at the comedy condo, which is the place they put you up at that's nearish to the club.
And most
of
the time, as comics, we'll complain about the condo. Oh, don't eat the mayonnaise. Oh, be careful what's in the fridge. Hey, watch out for the bed, you know. But I was just so excited to be out there. I slept on the couch because it was only two rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the headliner got the big room. Middle act gets the second room. And it was just a living room. So I'm laying there on this beat up couch watching TV. And I'm just smiling ear to ear on my phone. On a cell phone talking, you know, for free, because as an employee of the cell phone company, my phone was free. And so again, the headliner and the middle act are like, hey, can I borrow your phone if it's free? I'm like, sure, here you go. And so these guys are just on the phone for hours.
So for you, it was like, this is what I should be doing.
Yes, yes. It was my first taste of like, oh, wow, is this how it's going to be? You know, this is so cool. I didn't care. I didn't want to be in no fancy hotel or whatever. I just love the fact that I was on the road and I was going up on stage.
Quick break to talk about Geico. Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal when it comes to great rates on insurance for everything? Geico can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance. They're all covered with Geico. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use Geico mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to Geico. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
Stream the biggest movies and TV shows for free on Pluto TV. Watch movies like Titanic and G.I. Joe The Rise of Cobra, plus TV shows like CSI and Star Trek The Next Generation. Starting this month, check out the 24/7 Stargate channel exclusively on Pluto TV, plus hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows absolutely free. Download the free Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start watching today.
The Jordan Harbinger Show, a different kind of sponsor for this episode, the Jordan Harbinger Show. Well, if you're a fan of fascinating podcasts and interesting people, you should definitely check this one out. There's an episode for everyone, no matter what you're into. Jordan talks with Scott Adams about persuasion in a world where facts don't matter anymore. Man, is he right. Or you go inside the dark world of wildlife trafficking. You'll always find something useful to apply to your own life, like routine changes to boost productivity or slight mindset tweaks to change how you see the world. Jordan's a good guy. We've had him on many times. I know the man well, and he's worth a listen. We enjoy the show, and we know you will too. So you can search The Jordan Harbinger Show, that is H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, a new nut hath arrived. April ushers in the return of not just spring, but a new Adam's Monthly Nut. This month includes a sample pack of Brewpub Jerky, expertly crafted to drink with beer. We've also got a sample pack of Renewed Chaga Chino to make sure your coffee isn't just giving you jitters in the morning. When you're putting shrooms or snickerdoodle coffee mate in your cup of joe, make sure you rinse it after. This month, we've got a mug to remind you to do just that after you're done. And finally, you know the guys from Caviar Farm well enough by now. And this month, you'll get a $25 off coupon to be used site-wide at thecaviarfarm.com. We're not sure how we did it, but this entire box is just $25 at CorollaDrinks.com. Sign up for one or keep the shipments coming at CorollaDrinks.com. The Adam Carolla Show presents Gabriel Iglesias' birthday cocktail party for July 15th. Let's see who's here. We welcome the Dutch painter, Rembrandt. The woman who wrote the lyrics for I'm in the Mood for Love and The Way You Look Tonight, Dorothy Fields, is here. From Airwolf, Jan Michael Vincent. Linda Ronstadt joined the party. Let's welcome the architect of progressive music, guitarist for the band Yes, Peter Banks. Also from Yes, Trevor Horn. Jesse the Body Ventura is here. The singer for Ambrosia, David Pack. Forrest Whitaker is here. So is comedian Eddie Griffin. Let's welcome guitarist Joe Satriani. And look who's Huffington posting up at the bar. Ariana Huffington. Gabriel Iglesias on the Adam Carolla Show.
Yeah, the excitement of getting paid for the first time, like just a notion of getting paid to do comedy. It's that concept. it's revelatory. Like, I do remember, like, when I got paid to do comedy, and it was like, goddamn, that was the biggest game changer.
When I first started getting paid, I wasn't like, inspired to, oh man, I gotta quit my day job, or I gotta, oh, like, this is it right here. I knew that it was nice that I was being paid, but I already knew that I had a job that I was doing way better. And so it really didn't, like, I wasn't ready to quit the job yet. I was totally up for burning the candle at both ends. I was 20. I had all the energy in the world. I could be up all night. My hangovers lasted 2 minutes, and, you know, I was good. But it wasn't until I did TV, I did a show on Comedy Central. My first TV show was a show called Make Me Laugh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, they brought that back.
Yes. So
that's like a 70s show.
Yeah. Yeah. You know how it is. They always bring them back.
Right.
So I did this show, and they said, you did really well. Would you like to do a second one? And I'm like, sure. And they're like, the producers really like you. Do you want to do a third? Sure. So I did 3 shows in one day, and then I got the check for that. And that check just blew my mind. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? One day's work and they paid me this. And it was so much more than what I
think.
It was scale, but, you know, after, I'm trying to remember back then. I want to say that between the 3 shows, it was probably something around $3,000.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit more than that. But I did that in a day, whereas it took me a month to make the 5.
Right.
And so that was like, ooh, if I do a lot of these, I don't got to do any of those.
Right.
And before I know it, I went out for this show. And that's when I realized, just because there's, you know, you get a development deal. I wound up getting a development deal to do a sketch show. And I didn't realize, oh, the show has to get picked up before you start really, you know. I just thought, oh, it's a deal. It's already done. And so I wound up quitting my job. And then the development deal fell through. The show didn't never happen. And I went from making $5,000 a month to making nothing a month because I refused to go back to mm-hmm. work. I wanted to make stand-up work. And so I was basically making about anywhere from 50 to 150 a month now.
That was it?
That was it. And so I went through my old money really quick, and I wound up getting evicted from my apartment. My roommate, he goes, dude, you're stupid. Just go back to work, man. They'll give you your job back. I go, I will not go back to work. And everybody was beating me up, but my mom, my sister.
How old were you at this point?
I was 21.
Oh, it's just a year later.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was, you know, but I did not want to go back. So I says, okay, I got to make some money. Let me just do something where I can make some cash. So is it
like symbolic for you?
Very much so. I knew that I had to take a chance, and I knew that I was onto something, but I knew that I could not go back.
Mm-hmm.
So I was willing to take day jobs for cash. So I remember that when I was working at the Homebase store, which is, you know, again, like a Home Depot, I met a lot of contractors. A lot of contractors wanted to hire me to go to school and become a foreman because I was bilingual. So they wanted me to be able to run the office and be able to talk to the guys and the, mm-hmm. you know, the crew and stuff like that. So I reached out to one of them and I said, hey, look, I don't have a job right now. And I was like, oh, great, I'll send you to school, blah, blah, blah. I go, look, I go, I just need some regular get my hands dirty work. Do you have any? And they're like, dude, seriously? They're like, you're overqualified for what we have. And I'm going, I'll do anything. He goes, all we have right now is just digging ditches to set up for the walls that we're going to build in the ground at these houses.
Sorry. Yeah.
And so I go, I'll do it. And so next thing I know, I'm out there, you know, got a shovel, freaking making holes.
Making $9-$10 an hour?
He would pay me $40 cash a day. So remember, this was 1997, 98.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, okay, thank you. And he, at the end of the day, he's like, really?
You want your mind blown, by the way? I was doing some moving around some stuff at the shop up the street, across the street from the Home Depot up here. Mm-hmm. So I told my guys, I go, we'll go to the Home Depot and get some laborers, and let's let those guys help move some of the stuff because you guys are like high dollar guys and I don't need you schlepping everything around. And so go across the street, go to the corral, go where the guys are, the laborers are, mm-hmm. and grab a couple of them and bring them back. And then that was a few days ago. And then I showed up this morning and I said, where's the labor guys? Like, why are you guys doing all this stuff? I thought you were going to grab a couple guys from Home Depot. And they said, yeah, nah, we went over there, but it's too much. I said, what's, there's just Home Depot guys waiting in the parking lot. I said, It's $250 a day. I said, $250 a day? No tools, no nothing, just $250 a day for day laborers at the Home Depot. It's probably not that way if we were in Iowa. But,
probably not.
But it's $250
Prices
day.
Have gone up.
No shit.
Prices have gone up.
So you were getting
$40
for digging. You're calling them ditches, but I'll call them
footings. You know exactly what they are. You know,
there were footings because they were putting a block wall or something in. So they were, 24 wide, 24 deep.
I was driving out to Tustin because, Tustin was very a new development. Basically, it was a newer city. You know, Irvine was more of like ooh, but Tustin was like, okay. So we're out there in this new community, and so the guy had a contract to build all these walls in the backyards, and so that's what I was doing.
Look, I used to dig ditches too. I had that job, and it is, first off, it's as slow as a day can go. You know what I mean? Like when the
sun's in your face, it's slow. You're dry at a certain point.
I tell people all the time. They go, oh, you're digging a ditch. I go, yeah, you're planting a dwarf avocado tree in your backyard. Try doing it for 8 hours. Just dig, just nothing else but digging. And that's what they give the guys who don't have any skill, obviously, because anyone can dig. But I'm surprised because, I did it out of sheer desperation. I had nothing. But you had the stand-up, or at least you had a taste of it, and you had the phone sales sitting in some air conditioning, making $5,000 a week, or a month, or doing pretty good for yourself. It's weird that you had that kind of pride where you're like, I don't want to go back into this easy, lucrative thing. I'll go into the world's hardest job for $40 a day cash. That's pretty backbreaking stuff and go do it just all because you didn't like the optics of getting back into your old job, or you thought maybe it would suck you back into it.
I knew that I was onto something, and I just feel like a lot of times when you get too comfortable with something, you're afraid to step out of that. And I just knew that, at least digging the holes in the ground, I wasn't committed to it. I could walk away at any time, and my rent was $350 a month. So as long as I cleared my rent, I was going to be okay. But even then, I still couldn't do it because then the repo guy is now looking for my car because now I can't even pay for my car. And then, getting kicked out of the apartment. And then my brother took me in, and I wound up sleeping in his balcony for like 3 months over the summer. That's another story.
Outdoors.
And then my sister took me in. And so my sister took me in, and she basically said, get a job. And I go, look, I'm trying to do this comedy thing. She goes, well, do whatever it is you got to do. And so I was always making phone calls, calling, this is when you had to network. There was no social media. So you just had to pick up the phone and call the few comics you did know. Hey, do you know any numbers to any clubs or any place I could send a tape? You had to send a tape. You couldn't just send a link through your phone. Right. It was very much, time consuming, and you had to find somebody who had a camera, somebody who could record. Oh, I got a friend who's got two cameras and they can edit back and forth. Oh my God, that's crazy. And so, for me, going back to my regular job just wasn't an option because I enjoyed the cool things that I had. Like, okay, with money, I could buy the cable box. With money, I could buy the entertainment center. I could buy the nice Tempur-Pedic mattress. But at the end of the day, I was not enjoying what I was doing. Whereas, man, I didn't care if I was sleeping on that filthy couch in El Paso. I knew that at the end of the night, I was going to be up on stage doing what just made me feel happier than anything else. And so it was that almost like a drug where it was so overwhelming and it felt so good. And I'm like, oh, man, I used to say I would do this for free.
Well, when you were, I was thinking back on my days digging ditches, and I like to talk like you do and perform and be in front of people and share ideas and stuff like that. And so the monotonous physical job was a little bit of torture because you weren't communicating. You were doing the opposite of what you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But it also kind of freed you up to think about things. Like in a way, doing a repetitive physical action, your brain just floats above. You just go
you can do it under any situation. You're because I got it. You're like, oh, okay, there you go. Yeah. Just whatever. Yeah, it's the same. It's
right.
It's
so would you find yourself sort of going nuts, or did you get kind of zen about it and we're like, I'm gonna come up with routines or bits or you know, like we did, you could bring a notepad and go like, oh yeah, I gotta write this down.
I used to in my car, and I still do this. I'll have an idea about something, and back then I used to try to come up with bits, whereas now I'd rather just share a story about something that happened than try to animate the story and just make it, you know,
build it out.
You build it up, and then you add a voice, you add a sound effect to it, or you create a little thing around it to just, you know, to drive the story and the movement so it's going somewhere, versus, oh, let me just try to come up with a bit. But I would sit in my car, you know, while driving to work, and I just start talking out loud and trying to do bits with voices and characters and tell stories about people I knew at work, or try to do impressions of people at work just to keep myself, keep it going, you know?
You had to be the only laborer who pulled up in a nice car.
Yes, I had a Oldsmobile Regency 98.
That was fairly new.
It was used when I bought it, but it was very nice. It's a very nice car. They used to call it the Mafia staff car. It looked cool. It was a, you know, people thought it was a Cadillac or a Buick. You know,
I've been on enough construction sites. It must have been weird to see you pulling up in a nice car and then walking out and grabbing a shovel.
Oh, and the other guys with shovels would talk smack to me too, because they're like, you know, they would tell me in Spanish. They'd say, hey, you. They'd say, hey, tú que hablas inglés, ordenanos una pizza, which is, hey, you, the guy that speaks English, why don't you use that cell phone and order us a pizza?
See, that was the other thing, too, is most of the guys I worked with were Latin, too, but my Spanish was so bad, there's nothing to talk about. I was just, you know, I was just gringo.
Just order food,
digging,
you know?
Hey, digging cerveza. Alone.
Cerveza.
Yeah. It's
baño.
Yeah, but there's something about those guys. There's lessons that can be learned.
Oh, no comic has ever hazed me as hard as I was by those guys on that construction site.
Yes,
the shit talking was just like, oh, like you'd leave there like, oh, that, oh, I felt.
Well, they
that.
Must have been confused by you, because
they would call me stupid every single day.
You speak perfect English. You speak Spanish. You pull up in an Oldsmobile. You're digging ditches. You're doing voices, you're telling jokes. Like, they must not have known what the fuck to make of you, because there's not a lot of range in those guys. It's kind of the same story, the same fat wife, the same shit. I ate cactus for the first time with one of those guys. He brought his wife, like, made food for him and whipped out the tortillas, and he whipped me up what I thought was like a soft taco, and I was like,
you had cactus.
Yeah, I was like, what the fuck is this? What kind of chicken is this? And he's like, it's cactus, man. And yeah, I was like, cactus?
That's Mexican soy.
I go, where do you get cactus? I was thinking like a white guy, like, what part of the supermarket sells cactus? And he just pointed hill in Burbank. He's like, send my wife up there. Goes and gets the cactus.
Go get nopales, yeah. And I grew up on cactus. So
you
I,
did?
Yeah, yeah.
Could your mom make?
My mom would make cactus. She'd dice it up and cook it with eggs.
Would she go out and?
I have no idea how she acquired her cactus.
I've lived in a nice house or two with cactus in it, and out front and shit. Once in a while, you see a nice big machete swipe, and the whole thing's missing.
Yeah.
And if you go hike around the Hollywood Hills, like under the Hollywood sign and shit, you will see someone's out there getting cactus. What if your mom? She didn't buy it, right?
I have no idea. Again, there's so many questions I have about, you know, I was fortunate enough to have an amazing mom, but I wish I could have her now and know her as an adult. I only knew her as a kid who, you know, started going out there and telling jokes and, you know, didn't really have a, you know, I didn't go to college. I didn't have, you know, other experiences that most normal people would. I was on the road immediately.
Do you did you like cactus?
No.
Yeah, nobody likes
but
cactus, right?
It was one of those, my mom made it for me and I ate it, you know. Cómetelo. Okay. Cómetelo. Okay. I don't eat cactus now.
Oh,
but the point is, those guys out there would haze the hell out of me and trying to explain that I was this guy trying to do stand-up comedy.
Did they have a good name for you, like Bota de Queso or something?
I'm sure they had names for me. I have no idea. I mean, they would just haze me left and right and just talk smack, but there was no one name.
We had one husky Hispanic guy, electrician's son or something. He was known as Bota de Queso. So they
ball of cheese.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're trying to say, right?
Yeah.
Is it bola de queso?
Yeah, they called it like they saw it over there,
okay,
you know?
Yeah, ball of cheese. Well, that sounds good, but I don't know if being called that is a thing.
Kid was 15. Felt bad for him. I I just remember they just sort of said what they thought. I think
No filter. There's no,
filter.
They didn't care about hurting your feelings. There was no concern of shaming anyone. There was no body shaming back then. You were, if you were fat, you knew it because you'd look in the mirror and you'd hear it.
Did they? Did you? How long did you stay in the footing or the ditch? Did you ever get out of the ditch and like end up doing some crown molding or something?
No. I did that for I want to say a couple of months. And during this time I got evicted, again, went to go live with my brother for a little bit. It's a messed up story, but what wound up happening was, I accidentally killed my boss's dog on the job.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had that happen too.
The boss goes, "Hey, go get these guys some sodas." And so I got in my car and I'm pulling out of the driveway, and I didn't realize that he had I knew he had a little dog. He had like a little Yorkie, and the dog, I guess, was blind and deaf, and I had no idea. I didn't see the dog in front of my car, and I don't want him running the dog over. And so once that happened, it was devastating. It was one of the most traumatic things I'd ever been through. You know, I had to run over to my boss and tell him, "Hey, I'm sorry, but I just, you know." And then to watch the guy was just – he was probably already in his 80s. And to watch this guy just fall to the ground and just – it was – I couldn't take it. I basically just – I'm sorry. And I never came back. That was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had the same thing happen almost on a construction site.
Mm.
It was – there was a guy, my foreman, his name Mike. Horrible, horrible guy. Hated him. Yelled at everybody. Intimidated everybody, threatened everybody. You know, that's how it was. Everyone, there was no, it was lawless. You know what I mean? People threatened people and all that kind of shit. The only time the guy was in a good mood, he had a little pit bull puppy named Buckwheat. And he loved the puppy. And he'd be one of these guys who's an asshole to everybody. And then he'd be like, "Oh, Buckwheat." Yeah. And he was in a good mood again. And we're all standing there. And he said, "I'm going to the lumber store. Now look out for Buckwheat." And he kind of handed us Buckwheat and got in his pickup truck and took off. It was on Wilshire Boulevard. And he got in his pickup truck and took off down the driveway, set Buckwheat down. Buckwheat started chasing the truck. Mike turned off onto Wilshire and just headed to the lumber yard. And Buckwheat ran out into the street and got run over. Now he's gone. He's not coming back for an hour and a half. Buckwheat's dead. And we're all just sitting there going, this guy's kind of guy, get a pickaxe out of his truck.
He's going to swing
at you. I just remember being like, oh, God, it's just the worst. We're all just sitting around. We're like trying to get back to work. But when Mike pulls back up in the pickup, who's going to go talk to him? So we got a little, we're very simpatico.
Who wound up having to tell him the bad news?
Well, thankfully, he handed it to a guy named Jeff Gaines. And he was big. Jeff is a big dude. And he was a surfer fireman. Mm. So I was like, we elect you, Jeff, to go tell Mike what happened to Buckwheat, which is heavy. But by the way, I did it for another 10 years after that. I didn't leave.
You were still there for that long.
I didn't have the comedy chops that you had back at the tender age of 21, 22. Quick break to talk about Geico. Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal? Well, when it comes to rates on insurance, everything Geico, they can help. Insure your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even homeowners or condos insurance, renters coverage as well. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle. So get to Geico, get your bundle on, switch today and see just how much you can save. Simply go to geico.com and get your quote today. I want to get back to you sleeping on your brother's balcony because I don't know if I'm picturing the right apartment, but you can kind of judge an apartment complex by what's on the balcony. When you go into certain neighborhoods, you see a lot of super depressing kids' toys pushed out there and towels and laundry and shit. And I'm always like, you go to a really nice neighborhood, there's just a couple of chairs out on the balcony.
The balcony is used to enjoy the scenery.
It's not part of the apartment, where they're using storage. And I used to work in I used to do earthquake rehab in Koreatown and stuff. And those balconies would just be filled with shit Always got depressed when I saw the kids' toys out there because that meant there were kids inside that hellhole. But I never saw a Mexican sleeping on a balcony.
So here's the deal. My brother was an apartment manager for this very large apartment complex, okay? And so one of the biggest issues he had as an apartment manager was people saying, oh, it's only going to be two or three people that are going to be living there, and then finding out that it's like, you know, 10.
What city was this in?
Anaheim. Mm-hmm. And so he was always having to crack the whip on everybody. Like, hey, look, you said it's only going to be three. This is the price because it's only three, and you have all these people there.
Right.
And they were, you know, of course, hey, come on. Oh, they're visiting. And like, it's been 2 months. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, then you got to change the thing, and it's got to be – it was always an issue. So my brother was hardcore about following the rules and making sure that everybody was doing what they were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got in my situation where I, you know, I was evicted – my brother said, all right, you come live with me, but here's the thing. And I go, I'll sleep on the couch. He goes, I can't have you sleeping on the couch because people come by at 7 a.m. every morning with issues that are, you know, it's a huge complex. So every morning someone would show up, hey, you know, señor, the sink is leaking. Or, hey, you know, there's an issue with the toilet. Hey, there's an issue with the lights. So he always needed to address things. And he goes, I can't do that if my brother, you know, I can't be enforcing that whole too many people in the house if my brother's sleeping on the couch.
Mm.
You know, they're going to see that when I open the door.
Man, your brother so goes, with the rules.
Yeah, a little bit of a dick back then. But anyway, he goes, he says, look, man, if you sleep on the balcony, I'm not going to mess with you. There's a blind thing so you can pull it down so you don't get hit in the face with the sun. And you can chill out there. There's a futon. And it was a bit, even though it was a big balcony, I was outside. It was summertime. So, you know, I wasn't freezing.
Mm-hmm.
I was out there on the balcony with his bird. He had a bird. And so the bird and I were roomies out there on that balcony.
I was like, what time did you go to bed?
Well, you know, as a comic, dude, you know, sometimes we go to bed, you know, sometimes we don't. I was up really, really late. I'd always come home really, really late. And so hearing that 7 o'clock in the morning, because he says, you can sleep on that couch. He goes, but you got to be up and out by 7. And I'm like, there's no way, dude. I'm going to bed freaking 4.
Right.
You know.
Would he let you watch TV through the sliding glass door?
I didn't really hang out. You know, uh-huh. It was more so just that I needed a place to sleep. I would keep myself busy during the day doing whatever, but I didn't want to be, you know, in the way. My sister got word after a couple months that I was sleeping on my brother's balcony. She goes, just cut that shit. Grab your clothes. Come over the house. You know, we'll figure it out. And so I wound up sleeping on her couch until I was able to make comedy work. It took me a couple years to really start making money. And then eventually I started chipping in. And then we wound up moving into a two-bedroom. And then I just started paying half the rent.
Mm. Your brother sounds a little douchey.
Yeah. I got a couple issues going on there. But that's another story.
Did he change his tune at all when you got really successful?
Yes and no. we could do a whole 2 hours on this topic alone. I don't really have the best relationship with him. I haven't talked to him in about 10 years, but I saw him about a month ago by accident.
By accident?
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
I went to go pick up my nieces, and he came outside because he was picking up a delivery from FedEx.
Mm-hmm.
And FedEx and I rolled up at the same time.
Mm.
And so his wife, my sister-in-law, was like, hey, look, you know, she's just trying to make us,
yeah,
you know, be at peace. And so he came over, looked at me, I looked at him, and he's like, hey, you know, hey. And he tried to shake my hand, and I'm like, you know, I give him a fist bump. I go, I don't shake hands no more, man. It's just freaking COVID.
Well, so, you know, the moral of the story is don't be a douche. But if you're going to be a douche, make sure you're douchey to the right people. Because you never know where people are going to end up. And I don't know, do you financially take care of people in your
yeah,
family?
Yeah. There's you know, but it's not a back in the day it was definitely excessive, and I think over the years it was like, you know, I had to start blocking and cutting people off because I'm like, what are you? You're just relying on me and you're not doing anything for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so there comes a point where it's just, no, you're just taking advantage. And they're like, no, you need to help. Why do I need – there's nothing wrong with you. It'd be different if you were in a wheelchair. You have issues with – you know, you can't find work. And even if you can't find work, I'm sure you can get unemployment. But, you know, it'd be different. Oh, they're about to take away the car or the house is in jeopardy or something where it's a one-time help versus being
– right.
You know, now it's an expected thing.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell me I have a limited amount of experience with this and family and people and stuff you do, people you do stuff for. I've never found that it really worked.
Anybody I've tried to help, anytime money gets involved, it's going to go to shit. I've never had one situation where I tried to help someone out financially and they always say, oh, loan me the money. I don't think I've ever been paid back. There's never been a time when it's like, you know, well, I'll pay it back on the 15th, and then the 15th comes, and then the money comes. It's always like you just got to just eat it. You know?
No, it's never happened. And that the sort of math part I get, like you need money, so you're probably going to need more money, and you're probably not very good at making money, and I don't expect to be paid back. But there's an emotional element of it, which is like you could put someone's kids through private school and not get a Christmas card that year. From that person. You know what I mean? Like there's mm-hmm. a weird, I've found the people I've given nothing to are much nicer and much more generous.
Thank
and,
you.
I think it's an overcompensation or something. They feel some guilt, maybe some shame. I think there's some shame that's attached to you helping them out or bailing them out, which makes them sort of, they overcompensate and sometimes even get a little bit nasty, and you end up walking away from it going, the fuck, I just put a roof on your house. Why are you being a dick?
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, there's been a few instances that were very, very similar to that.
It's an epidemic. It's never, oh, let me make you a big cactus stew.
Nice.
No, it's the opposite, and it's weird, and but it's consistent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing.
And it's like you're being guilted for being successful. So because you're successful, you have to automatically, you know, you gotta help out.
And they
because you got there.
They
so
also
gotta,
think they think you have a magic wand too. They're like, could I get a job on your site, on your thing with the thing? And then you go, are you in the union? And they go, no, I'm not in the union. Well, the showrunner says you got to be in the union. They're like, come on, you could do something. It's like, no, I can't.
Yeah.
I don't have a magic wand. I could suggest, but if you're not in the union,
I've been guilted so many times into situations that I'm just like, why did I even go there? Why did I try? And unfortunately, I've lost a lot of family members. I don't talk to anybody. I mean, there's maybe one sister that I talk to out of, you know, the four.
I don't what I don't get about these people, could be family, could be old people from the neighborhood, or sometimes it's just a neighbor. Like I've had some horrible neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm a rich guy who's a journeyman carpenter who's got a garage full of tools. I could be the best neighbor you ever had. I'm the neighbor you want. I could fucking fix anything. And I'll tell you a joke. Why are you getting me to hate you? What's in it for you? You know what I mean? Like you're a generous guy. You're a nice guy. You could have a nice relationship with you. I could be coming by the warehouse in Long Beach and checking out some of the micro buses and the 23 window and the 21 window.
Right.
And then you'd comp me a couple of tickets to Dodger Stadium and get me a couple of laminates, and I'd be drinking some IPA backstage. And after the show, you'd invite me to the party because we're having an after party. Could all just be in that. I could live in that world with you. You didn't have to give me $1 million. You could just like me. I'm mm-hmm. family. I'm an old friend from the neighborhood. What's wrong with that? Why do people fuck that up? And they fuck it up. They fuck it up. That's the crazy part.
Yeah, because I don't like any of my neighbors.
No.
They're all, yeah.
Yeah, there's something. It's weird, right? Like, why are you establishing that? Or why, you know, my thing is like, why do you want to have this kind of relationship with me?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of good stuff I could do for you. Why this? I mean, sometimes you'll see it with an employee. Sometimes you'll see it with a friend. Lots of sort of old neighborhood guys where you're like, right. Once I got in a position, I was like, I can help you now. And they're like, you're not the boss of me. You know, I wasn't like, I'll give you money. I was like, I can get you a job. I can get you a job in the business.
Yeah.
And they're like, fuck off. Weird, right?
Yeah.
You ever have that?
Yeah, many times. Many. As you're saying it the whole time, I'm like, uh-huh. And I'm attaching names to each mm-hmm. one of your little stories. Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's that guy. Uh-huh.
What? And that's why I get angry at people when they go like, you know, there's this like misconception where people go like, he just needs an opportunity. These people just need a chance. They just need an opportunity. You know how many fucking opportunities I've tried to hand to people? Yes. And they told me to fuck myself. How many times have you like when I can help you do this, but you got to show
up
here?
I've lost count. And all it takes is just show that you're trying. Just be present. Don't make me look like an asshole for trying to extend this and bend over backwards to create moments.
Right.
And opportunities. And now, it sucks. It really does. You know, and again, you feel like, for me, I've always felt guilted. I felt shamed that, oh man, I'm not doing enough to help. But after a while, it's like, if you're not even trying to help be a good person to me, why should I extend all this to you? If all you're doing is bringing guilt, drama, freaking, you know, bad attitude. You know, it doesn't take a lot. You know, again, be on the good side. Why be on the bad side? Why approach it that way?
I'll tell you whose fault it is. It's society's fault. It's not their fault. They're fucking idiots. It's their friends, their family members, spouse, because you know they get with them. And they go, oh, I was just trying to ask Fluffy if I could do something on his new TV show. And he just fucking slammed the door in my face. And then everyone goes, well, you know what it's like. You start off as a nice guy. Then all of a sudden you get this big head because Hollywood comes a-calling. And now he thinks he's too good for the old Jenny on the block anymore. He wants to hang out with it. It is not that. It's that person's a fucking lazy dick and is grabby and greedy. And the person who's talking to them, their loser buddy or wife or husband should be going, how about you fucking put your hat in your hand, put your pride aside and get the fuck back in there. Tell them you're sorry and make yourself useful.
Thank you.
Instead, they sit there and they go, yeah, I know. No, yeah. I know. He's changed. Yeah, he's different. Well, you know, money, it does that to people. Fuck off.
Wow. Hey, you want to hang out? Yeah, I got cars and people you can talk to like that.
I'll show up at your shop and yell to everyone you went to high school with. You want me to do that for you? You don't have to play the heavy, Fluffy. I'll do it. For a change, I'll be the heavy one.
Oh, man. Yeah, you can drive anything you want. Yeah, come on.
We should do a podcast called Successful People and All the Assholes They Went to High School With, and we just get them all drunk, and they just fucking go off.
Wow.
On all their stories of all the people they tried to help and how shitty they all were.
Yeah.
And
it's a lot.
How you become the asshole in the equation.
Always. You're always the dick. You're always the, ooh, look at you. Right. Oh, Hollywood. Oh.
And I don't know if at least I got white people to deal with. I don't know if there's a cultural thing where they think
got a whole rainbow, man. Hey, everybody, you name it.
You got them all,
everybody.
Huh?
Everybody.
Everybody. You make me laugh.
Yeah, I got to hear about cactus, and I got to hear about, you know, molasses and shortbread, and also hear about, you name it, man. You know.
How's your mom season those eggs, man? I can't, cactus and eggs, it sounds like fucking fried hell to me.
I don't know how she would do it, but, I ate it. I didn't ask how it was made.
So now you move in with your sister, and you're doing okay. You got your two-bedroom now. You got your own bedroom. You're off the balcony.
I'm off the balcony.
You got a roof.
That was my first tour, the off-the-balcony tour.
Off the balcony tour. And you're starting to get a little traction in the comedy department?
I made my own little office desk in the kitchen. You know, basically it was just a phone and a notepad and a little tiny Rolodex type thing where you just put numbers in it because, you know, I still couldn't really, you know, use the phone that way. I no longer had my cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't afford it.
Right.
You know, and so I was just making phone calls and, you know, making my connections and, all right, okay, here, hey, we can get you $150 here. You're going to go to freaking Des Moines or go to over here or go over there. And little by little, just building that up. And it wasn't until I did my Comedy Central half hour special that I got a little heat from that and started working a lot more clubs. And
How old were you when you did that?
About 22, 23.
Wow.
It started moving pretty quickly once I started getting TV under my belt. And then I was on a show on Nickelodeon called All That. So I did a whole season with them there. And that was a game changer because now I was making TV money. weekly as a, you know, basically a lead. And so every week bringing home these big checks. I forgot one check one time. That's how much money was coming in. And that's when I moved out of my sister's house. And then I moved into a I moved here to Burbank or next door in Burbank. And I lived in a townhome.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing very well for myself. And then, you know, started going on the road and then little by little creating a following. There were certain markets where I could go and sell tickets and I would get door deals.
Right. So you got 80% of whatever the door was or whatever it is?
Whatever the deal, you know, the deals always start off like 70 and then 75 and then 80. And if you're, once you're like calling your own shots, you get 95.
Right. And if you're selling out multiple shows,
mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ, something like Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, there's no, because people have asked me, hey, did you ever think, no, I just wanted to pay my rent. I just wanted to pay, that's all I wanted. That was my only goal. I want to pay my rent. I want to stay home.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is to make money doing what you want to do and make enough money so that you can be semi-comfortable doing what you want to do. And then everything past that's just kind of gravy, right?
Right.
But now Dodger Stadium was... So what's it cost to just get the venue of Dodger Stadium?
Ooh, you're looking at the numbers I've seen so far. It's over $1 million.
So rent. So if I wanted to do, like, I'm not, like, I've seen the lottery commercials where the family wins the lottery and then they, like, rent out Dodger Stadium and they play, like, a softball game at Dodger Stadium. So it's like, if you want that venue for a night, it's $1 million.
The price I'm coming up with is we're going in and we're there for over 3 days. So there's like a setup, you know, the time to set up, the first show, the second show, and then tear down. So that's a number of days that you're going to be occupying that space. I don't, for one night, I got to imagine it's a lot less, but because we're there over the course of, you know, more than half a week, that's why it's that price. Plus there's production on top of that.
Right. Yeah, so how many cameras, jibs, but booms,
there's
sets.
One price just for the building itself, and then there's all the other expenses with production, lighting, companies, and, you know, everybody's got to get their cut. You know, and the promotional companies, we got Live Nation, and then we got my promoter, and then just everybody that's, you know, so Netflix is in the mix, so it's a lot of moving parts.
Is it, you know, $1.5 million or $1.7 million or whatever just to put it on? Or somewhere in that.
For this thing to happen, it's costing close to three.
Close to three.
Mm-hmm.
So now obviously you can recoup a lot of that in ticket sales.
Ticket sales plus, remember, it's being recorded for Netflix. So, you know, once I turn it in for a special, then there's that.
Does Netflix pre-buy it with you or do you take it, edit it, and present it?
No, I have deals with Netflix. You can do it that way. That's one way that I did it. And then there's, once you have a deal with them, like, I had a deal to do two specials, these last two specials.
Mm-hmm.
So that's already, you know, that's already worked out. It doesn't matter if I want to do this special at the Ice House or if I want to do it at Dodger Stadium. You know, I already got the fee that they're going to give me.
Right. So you owe them two specials and you could go full Dave Chappelle or one of his specials or whatever, like just.
I can go full production, make it big and beautiful, or make it
the belly room,
basically,
of the Comedy Store, and light a cigarette. And he's the only guy who gets to smoke indoors. People talk about racism, but there's only one human being who gets to smoke indoors, and that is a black man. So we can't live in two races as a society, can we?
Oh, my God.
And now I'm thinking about Chappelle. You got your own fluffy, like, clothes line? You must have.
And that's another thing,
too. You got a lot of merch you're going to sell, right?
My, I had no idea that I was going to have such a huge merch business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's one of the things that took off that nobody saw coming, including myself. It was just one of those. I got lucky early on that I was just trying to find ways to make ends meet, you know, and supplement the income. And so I was making my own CDs back in the day and selling them at the shows. You know, I'd carry my own CD printer. And just,
really?
I have a buddy of mine who's, you know, still to this day, my original employee had a little CD tower and he was burning my CD to sell after the shows and I'd autograph the disc and, you know, and so instead of partying it up with that money at the end of the week, I'd invest and I'd buy more spindles. I'd buy more CD burners. And so I had a whole production line, and I just kept growing it and growing it. And then eventually I recorded a new CD the right way, and I did professional packaging and professional everything front and back. It was nice. And then I'd start selling that for more. And then I would invest and sell more and then record a second one. And then eventually started selling T-shirts and then a new T-shirt. And then now we got four shirts and now CDs, T-shirts, and then posters. Okay, posters. And then here's pictures. Okay, it's pictures. You started growing and growing and growing. Eventually, I took over my garage at the house. My girl was pissed, and I had to get a warehouse. And then got in the warehouse, and within a year, we grew out of the warehouse. And now I had to get a double wide. And in the course of 2 years, grew out of that. Now that's why I have the building I have now. And that this merch thing has just taken over. And what? So, you know, now there's everything under the sun, whether it's hats, T-shirts, freaking Funko dolls, other figures, you know, and I've made good relationships with a lot of different toy companies. And so we've got an awesome, our merch is awesome. It really
is. Where did the entrepreneurial kind of thing with you doesn't seem like it comes from the family. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But on the other hand, you were doing a great job selling those phones when you were 20. So there's always something in you that was kind of a salesperson to some degree, but now the entrepreneurial spirit is really coming to full bloom. Mm-hmm. Is that anything you studied, or has it just been a slow progression?
I had a real basic understanding of business, but you know, you're dealing with people every day, and you understand that, okay, supply and demand. Well, what do people want? What do people need? What are people willing to pay a premium for? You know, the cost of having a business. What does it cost to have a place to store? Is it cheaper to just make and not have a place to store or have someone else make it? Because a lot of times people don't want to deal with the day to day. They'd rather, oh, I'll just have this company do it and they send me a check.
Farm it out.
That's one way to do it, or you can try to grow it, make it bigger and better yourself. Because I found that I tried doing that early on, and I'm like, why am I doing that? I can do this better myself. I got inspired a lot from professional wrestling. I know it sounds random. I got inspired not so much for what happens in the ring. Okay, whatever happens in the ring is whatever happens in the ring. I'm talking about the way the shows are branded, the way the merchandise is set up, the way it's presented, like really high end quality things, the pricing of things, buying in bulk. You know, mm-hmm. You go to Costco enough times, you realize that, hey, the more you buy, the less it costs. And then, okay, this pen cost me 50 cents to make, and I turn around and sell it for $4.
Right.
Then you start to understand, okay, so much money you put away and so much money you enjoy and have fun with, and then, you know, continue to do this and then find the next thing like this to create, and then what's that going to cost?
What's a tour for you like now? Is it, you
know? It's insane. It's insane. We got 3 tour buses, 4 semi-trucks. It's a rock and roll show. It really is. Three tour buses, and I couldn't even tell you the names of the drivers, and it's sad because it's
4 semi-trucks.
4 semi-trucks. And one of those trucks is pure merch.
Wow.
Pure merch. And the rest is, of course, the production, the stage and everything. It's not just a curtain and a stage. It's like, no, there's moving parts. There's, you know, things that go up and down. There's lights. There's giant screens on the sides of the stage. And so when people show up, it looks – they're like, whoa, okay. You know? Also, too, I've kept the prices very, very, honest and realistic. I don't price gouge. I don't get too crazy with it. Yeah, the secondary market will blow up the ticket prices, but I make it very friendly. Like, for example, the Dodger Stadium, people could have seen that show for $19.
Wow.
Like the nosebleeds up on top, I made everything up on top, $19. Okay. And of course, the floor, it started at $130, and then it went from $19 to $130. So even then, you know, like a Lady Gaga show, it's $130 for the nosebleeds.
Right.
Like her cheapest ticket is my most expensive. And so, you know, but one of those things too. You want to make it so that everyone can come.
Man, if you guys ever became a power couple and it became Fluffy Gaga.
Fluffy Gaga.
I would watch that show.
Little Fluffy Gaga.
Fluffy I don't Gaga. Know why I like the way that sounds. So are you on the bus?
Are you flying ahead? We fly so let's say I'm working Thursday through Sunday. We fly out from Long Beach to wherever it is that we're at. They pick us up at the airport in the bus, and then from there we ride around, and then when it's time to leave, we on Sunday after the show, jump on the plane and fly back home.
Wow. Wow. Little boy in Long Beach. Eating cacti.
Eating cacti.
For breakfast.
For breakfast.
And now look at you. Well, last thought. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask your thoughts on the whole Chris Rock Oscar thing, since you're such a seasoned comedian. A lot of comedians have been weighing in. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I've had a lot of people say, hey, do you think that was staged? I go, no, there's nothing about that anybody could really benefit from.
Yes.
You know, people say, oh, well, Chris Rock's selling tickets. I go, Chris Rock was already selling tickets. You know, Jada's going to do the red table with Will, and, you know, it's going to be a big thing. I'm like, they don't need it.
And also, why would Will Smith agree to be a pariah? You know what I mean? Like, go up there and slap one of the most beloved comedians around and have everyone think you did it. What's in it for Will?
Real quick, my director of operations who's listening to us right now, she goes, it's five trucks. Thank you.
Five semi-trucks.
Five trucks. Thank you. Thank you.
Five. Sorry. Oh, my God. Five. You're so bad for the environment, Fluffy.
Right there, five trucks. I'm like, all right. Okay. Five trucks.
Five semi-trucks. Jesus Christ. I mean, you know, Led Zeppelin didn't do more than two in their prime, I guess. I mean, that's as big as any rock act on the planet.
The guy that's running everything, he works with the Foo Fighters. He works with all kinds of bands.
And yeah.
He's, you know, he goes, man, he goes, I had no idea that your shows were like this. And he took it on. And it's rock and roll. It's pretty cool.
So it wasn't the slap not done
on
purpose.
Anyway,
sorry.
Back. Thanks for the text. For me, I feel like Will Smith is going through so much that he has not dealt with.
Yeah.
And this was an opportunity for just him to have a little bit of control at that moment of something, even though it wasn't the smartest thing to do. I just think he was at the end of it, and he was tired of not dealing, and it built up, and that's what happened.
Yeah.
Because you could see the pain in his face.
Something's going on. It's like when you go to the supermarket and you got the woman in front of you and someone is saying to the woman, like, we don't accept a Discovery card. She's crying and you go, what's going on? And it's not really the Discovery card. Something else. There's something built up. Mm-hmm. There's something. She's having a meltdown and it's over almost nothing. That means there's something else in there
that's been percolating
for a while.
A lot of pain, a lot of things brewing, a lot of things that he's had thrown in his face, a lot of not dealing, which I think is the reason why you always see him being so overly positive, overly energetic, overly trying to be supportive and helpful, because I think a lot of times you push a lot of stuff out because you yourself need or want that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I just think that it's built up to a point now where it's like it's very toxic. And whatever he's not dealing with came out that night.
Well, thank you for that insight, Gabriel Iglesias. Dodger Stadium, don't worry about the show on May 7th. That's sold out. But still some tickets for the May 6th show, which has been added. And also, you can go to fluffyguy.com for all the info, or just follow the convoy of semi-trucks and they roll into town. Fluffy's going to be
He's
wherever they stop.
Down, load up in trucking.
Oh, yeah. The guy's, oh, God damn it. Get in that Trans Am with the chicken on the hood. Lead the five semi-trucks. Get the hat. Get the squawk box. We'll get a shot of you coming down the desert road. E-brake it. Get a little sideways, light it up, and take it off. Come on, man. Start the show that way.
That'd be kind of cool.
Film that
would
shit.
Be kinda, you know what's funny is that the car came with the Burt Reynolds hat. It came with the bandit hat.
Put the Burt Reynolds hat on. Get a nice shot of you going through the desert with those five semis behind you.
I think I got to do that.
All right, Gabriel. Always a pleasure, my friend. Great to see you as per usual.
Thank you, Adam.
My pleasure. Until next time, Adam Carolla for Gabriel Iglesias saying mahalo.
You can watch this episode of the Adam Carolla Show at youtube.com/Adam Carolla. Leave the show a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And get your tickets to see the Ace Man. Get them now at adamcarolla.com.
Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal. When it comes to great rates on insurance for everything, GEICO can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance. They are all covered with GEICO. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use GEICO mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to GEICO. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
Stream the biggest movies and TV shows for free on Pluto TV. Watch movies like Titanic and G.I. Joe The Rise of Cobra, plus TV shows like CSI and Star Trek The Next Generation. Starting this month, check out the 24/7 Stargate channel exclusively on Pluto TV, plus hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows absolutely free. Download the free Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start watching today.